So the
So, Michael, you were telling me about intercepting Russian aircraft, standoff missiles, and so on. Is there anything else of note that you think that you would like to mention about your time at 56 Squadron?
Well, yes. Two things, I think, come to mind. Firstly, the first year I was on the squadron, we were what's called the Royal Air Force's aerobatic team. And this was a wonderful hangover, archaic in my view, certainly in retrospect, of using a frontline squadron as the premier aerobatic team of the Royal Air Force, and the great sort of predecessors had all had Hunter aircraft, which was a wonderful airplane for it. So the Blue Diamonds and the Black Arrows, Treble One Squadron, who were I think the ultimate in an aerobatic team, quite superb. The airplane was perfect for it. The Lightning was quite ridiculous to turn into an aerobatic team. Quite ridiculous. I mean, it was two or three times the size, incredibly powerful, but designed to go at, you know, Mach 1.6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or even Mach 2 eventually, and simply not for whizzing around airfields and wasting a large amount of fuel and so on. It was a great individual aerobatic aircraft, but we were the last one because I think the foolishness of it was shown. So my first, you know, 4 or 5 months on the squadron was aerobatics was going on, and we didn't start doing our primary job that year until about September, October. And it was still pretty amateurish. I think I said before we started that it was a flying club. And it was. It was a jolly good flying club. We had a real sports car. But it was still pretty amateurish. People started to come into it who brought a little bit more professionalism. Well, we started to operate the airplane more effectively. For example, it was not an easy airplane to keep serviceable. In the days of the Hunter, you'd put 12 airplanes on the line, you'd rush off and fly, you know, 8 of them. And then you'd do that 3 times a day, and everybody would retire to the bar in the evening, and it was a great day. You'd be lucky to get 4 or 5 airplanes on the line with a Lightning in the morning, so you simply couldn't operate it that way, and we had to start operating it over a sort of 18-hour day. So the first shift, the first flight would come in and operate the airplanes up till 4 o'clock. The next lot would come in and from 4 o'clock till midnight. And the ground crew would shift around that, and there'd be a third shift repairing the airplanes at midnight. So it's now a 24-hour operation starting to emerge. But not only that, which was all about getting more out of the airplanes, but starting to realize that, you know, you had to have a more effective way of measuring your competence. And from about 1965 onwards, this started to emerge in the fighter business, and indeed in all the disciplines. But I remember it particularly in the fighter world.
Can you describe? I know we're jumping ahead slightly, excuse me, from sort of 59, 60, 61. But can you have a few comments about the way that the these new disciplines were imposed or were devised and imposed?
Well, I think I can just take you through a couple of sort of steps towards it. When I learned to fly the Lightning, there was nobody around to teach us to fly it who got very much experience on it because it was so new. So you'd go off and it was almost the blind leading the blind. I had couple of years on the squadron, and then I was sent back to what's called the Operational Conversion Unit, which was forming. Before that, it was just a flight of airplanes, because the airplane was so new. But more and more of them were coming in, so they formed an Operational Conversion Unit. So a number of us were arriving then as instructors at the Operational Conversion Unit, who had at least got, you know, a couple of years behind us. So we were getting a more professional. That's not to say the other guys weren't professional, but they just didn't have the experience on the airplane. More experience. And that started to manifest itself in the way that we taught them how to fly it. And we demystified it, I hope, which was very important. The other thing that happened was that instead of having to be superhuman, i.e., you know, above average and all these R's on it, they suddenly thought, well, actually, we've got a lot of these airplanes, and we haven't got enough superhumans around. Why don't we just take a chap straight from training and put him in there? You know, and they did. And actually, they took the best guys from training, but nevertheless, they took to it like a duck to water, as youngsters do. So we were getting youngsters coming in hugely enthusiastic, teaching them to fly, and all of that was starting to work through onto the squadrons, with people becoming the squadron commanders who'd now got 4 years' experience on the airplane, starting to introduce some real professional sort of approaches to it. And this, I think, was also surrounded by, within NATO, a dawning recognition that we were going to have to fight possibly a conventional war before we would go nuclear, which meant getting pretty professional at doing that. So NATO, particularly Air Forces, introduced this evaluation system, which took a while because it was really quite embryonic, but it eventually turned out to be the best thing that Air Forces have ever done, which was to test ourselves against a wartime criterion. And you know, you made or fell on your ability to get through those evaluations, and some people who cocked them up never saw the light of day again. So it was quite brutal, but actually it was what was needed. And I think, to be blunt, the Army ought to have had something like that. It took them a long time to start getting, you know, that sort of thing going. And they never really did. The Navy did. The Navy had it as well, and that's why they were very professional. But the Army didn't, and I think it was a big mistake.
Now, forgive my ignorance here. You have this... I'm now going to go back slightly. You have this brand-new aircraft. It's almost a blind lead, and a blind lead, as you've suggested. It's also a single-seater.
Mm.
So, of course, and I've seen two-seater Hurricanes. Were there any two-seater Lightnings?
Yes, every squadron had one two-seater Lightning, which, you know, you did your tests on. So how did you measure how people were doing? Well, you always flew as a pair or four, and you could tell whether the guy could cope. And actually, every sortie film was taken of the radar screen, and you could see everything that happened on it. And because you were flying in a way which you could really just about test every facet. Simple things like, let's say, every film was evaluated, so how did you down that? You'd go on camps in which you know, missiles would be fired, again, all filmed, all recorded, you could see all of that. Many, many exercises. And, you know, flying in weather, which was pretty difficult. You could bring an aeroplane back, you know, having flown at night out over the sea in 200-300 feet, landed on a runway which was only just long enough for the Lightning, do all of that. If you survived that, you know, you were competent.
Yes. And you were with 56 for...?
I did a couple of years with them. Then I went off to the conversion unit up the road at Coltishall in Norfolk, where I instructed there for about 2.5 years.
When out about 1964?
1964 to 67, yeah, that's right.
At Coltishall?
At Coltishall, yeah. It was quite a big station. We had quite a lot of Lightnings then, because the Lightning was now taking over from the Hunter and the air defence business throughout the United Kingdom and going to Germany as well. It was at that time that they changed from squadron leader, squadron commanders, to wing commander. Squadron commanders, a function, as we discussed earlier, of really experience, keeping experienced people flying, yes, but also just the sheer cost, the sheer value of the equipment that you were now operating.
And which the men, yes, the training involved in getting the men to that.
Indeed, indeed.
I don't know if this is, please guide me here, but this is now your second spell of instructing.
Yeah.
This one a genuine spell, the other one was a shorter spell.
This a much more operational level of instruction, obviously, with a frontline airplane, as opposed to teaching somebody to fly. They knew how to fly when they got to us.
Yes.
We converted them onto the airplane and into the ways of fighters.
Was this, in view of your very distinguished subsequent career, which doesn't happen to very many people, was this, were, if I may put it this way without causing you embarrassment, were the best men? Did they become instructors in this way, or was it still at that stage just whoever might be available?
Now, and I think one of the weaknesses of the system that I mentioned earlier was that, you know, if you start a new airplane off, where do you get the instructors from? And they just had to take some experienced people from other roles or other types of aeroplane. Quite a lot of them were ex-Javelin men. But that wasn't ideal. What you needed, and that's why I was turned around so quickly, you needed somebody who'd been an instructor, so he understood what instruction was about, but had now got some operational experience, put the two together and turned him into an operational conversion unit. Says it all, operational conversion unit. Instructor. You take the raw material which has been produced by flying training and you turn it into a citizen that can take his place on the front line.
And did you enjoy your time there? Are you in the air much? Or
yes, a lot of flying.
Oh, right.
A lot of flying, which was great. And I did the low-level aerobatics for a couple of years there, which was great fun. So I did demonstrations around the country, and that was nice. So I got a bit of extra flying that way.
And did the red arrows exist at this time?
No, they didn't. What happened was, after 56 Squadron had given that up, and the Royal Air Force had given it up, about 2 years later, they formed out of the Nats, which were at Valley, an organisation called the Yellow Jacks. From that grew the Red Arrows of about 1966 or 5. They got the Red Arrows had formed with Nats about that time.
Right. Mm. And after 2.5 years, probably quite hard work at Coltishall.
Yes, but we did what we didn't have, unlike the guys on the front line, we didn't have all this endless what's called QRA, Quick Reaction Alert, which meant you were on all night at 10 minutes readiness, 24 hours a day, you know, whatever. And that was very demanding. I mean, we only had 18 pilots or so on the squadron. And imagine that you're holding 24-hour alert. We used to do it for periods of about a month, I think. And then we'd have a month off and then another month on and whatever. That's very demanding. I mean, it was not uncommon to be doing 70, 80-hour week. Not uncommon at all in terms of being at work. You know, overnight you went. If you were on alert, you weren't doing anything. You were just reading and staying awake. But it took its toll. I mean, one was quite tired. On the OCU, you didn't have to do that. You did take part in the exercises. You still had a war role, but you didn't have to do the alert.
Right. Okay. What followed after that?
Well, they promoted me, to my astonishment, and sent me off to get what was at the time quite the best job for a lightning pilot in the Air Force, to be a flight commander on the first lightning squadron to be sent to Cyprus. We took over from a Javelin squadron in 1967, and I had two very happy years in Cyprus as a flight commander with some great flying. And
this is a squadron leader, of course.
Yes,
what is one
way. Exactly right, yes, yes, squadron leader.
With the extra pay, of course, I suppose.
With the extra pay and overseas allowance. I mean, you know, our pay almost doubled, I think. I think we almost reached the dizzy heights of 1,000 a year, didn't we? But it didn't pay. Very interesting question, comment there. You know, pay, actually, I won't say it was irrelevant. That's not true. I mean, you know, one thought, my God, how are we going to manage this month? But it was never a big issue. And I think it was because we lived in a cocooned world. The mess, the married quarters. The married quarters had help in the house. You know, this sort of thing. This was the compensating factor that you didn't worry about pay. Everybody had an old car, unless you were... Well, certainly when you were married, you had a jolly nice car until you were married, then you had an old car. And nobody went out and bought furniture. You know, and very few people owned their own homes, so you didn't have great mortgages hanging over you. And so life was, you've got 80 quid this month, and we'll spend 75 quid of it having fun, and £5 for the rent, or whatever it was. Different world, totally different today, utterly. We were very unmaterialistic in that sense.
Were service salaries at that time commensurate with commerce?
No, they were much lower, but there were these compensations.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Dennis Healy came in and introduced the military salary, took away all the perks, well, some of them, and raised the salaries.
Is this starting in 64, I suppose?
Well, no, he did it in, I remember it coming in when we were at Staff College, which was 1970, and this new military salary was introduced. I'm not saying that they hadn't done some things before, I really can't remember, but the idea was to do away with the perk, because the perks involved it very often employing other people to do things which you benefited from and didn't really appreciate that that was actually money. So if you took those away, you had to compensate, no doubt in governmental fashion. You know, they made a profit on it.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
You're now a flight commander in Cyprus. Can you elucidate a little, describe a little your role? Also, what it was like to be in Cyprus. This is a fairly interesting time in
very,
Ireland's history.
Very, yes, very. I think three elements which would be of interest. First one was we hadn't been there more than about 2 months, and the 1967 Arab-Israeli war erupted, and we were at 5 minutes readiness in the cockpits, because the Israelis weren't going to attack us, but the Egyptians might. And there was certainly a lot of muttering at the time that the Israelis, if you recall, who basically decimated the Arab air forces in one day, had help from the British. And so the thought was that, you know, we might get attacked. So that was quite interesting.
No truth in that rumour?
No, none at all. Absolutely none at all. We even sent all our Form 700s, which had all our flying in, to, back to London to be shown to King Hussein and people like this, all of whom were complaining that we must have helped them. Couldn't have been done by the Israelis, they said.
But the British did have four, if I can put it that way.
Yes. It's true. I think if I'd been an Arab and had such a devastating blow, I'd be amazed that I'd be astonished that they hadn't had help. It was a quite brilliant piece of military sort of engineering, really. I mean, their timing, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. If you remember, they struck these people. First of all, their intelligence was so good, they knew exactly what time they flew in the morning, so they didn't hit them first thing in the morning. They waited till they'd all gone for their first trip and had landed, and then were then sort of streaming off. So all the airplanes were lined up, and this was true in just about every base that they went to. And then they just came in and went whack. Absolutely no radio, you know, no possibility. Flew incredibly low, so they were below the radar screen. And the coordination of it was quite brilliant. I mean, it shocked the world. It didn't just shock the Arabs. It shocked the world because we looked and thought, my God, you know, they could do that there. They could do that to us. Somebody could do that to us. And suddenly, I thought, my God, you know, disperse all the lessons of World War II. Disperse your airplanes, for God's sake, get your act together. So it was a real wake-up call for a lot of us, actually. So that was the first quite significant event. And then at the end of that year, the Turks and the Greeks were having a go. So I think the two years I was there was characterized by some quite, you know, energetic things in which we were certainly, I don't think we expected to be shot down, but we were certainly patrolling in a way which we thought we might well get involved with other airplanes. And indeed, we did meet a number of Turkish airplanes and quite a lot of Israeli ones. And there was a lot of snooping around. I mean, that is the hub of intelligence in the world. So airplanes go around that part of the world not telling anybody about anything because they're all intelligence gatherers. So we had a huge amount of trade, as we called it. But the other thing that we did there, which I think was quite pioneering, was start to recognize that, you know, you had to be able to do all these things at low level, and you had to be able to fight. It wasn't going to be a bomber threat. It wasn't going to be the classic Russian bomber. It was going to be airplanes which could turn and would be coming in at low level. So we had to get good at that. And that was quite a struggle because the airplane that we had a pulse radar. And pulse radar, basically, unlike today's airplanes, which are Doppler-based, you have to be looking up at the target. Looking down, you get all the ground returns. So even over the sea, the return that you get on it. Can you take that?
I'm sorry, yes. The Doppler.
Are we still recording?
We're on again.
Okay, yeah. The Doppler gives you movement, relative movement. And that means that you can pick airplanes up relatively. This one was all about a radar return, which you could very easily lose in all the other radar returns. So on the Lightning, on the pulse radar, it was a hell of a job. But we found ways of doing it. And I tell you, intercepting a Buccaneer at night at low level when the thing's doing about 580 knots was, in a very, very dark world like the Mediterranean, this was probably one of the most challenging things I've ever done in an aeroplane.
And absolutely. You do it at 200 or 300 feet?
Yes. We used to try and give you an idea of what was involved. We tried to sit at 1,000 feet and just pick them up, so we got a very slight lift on the radar. And then you'd have to descend in the turn and let down. And if you can get your missile to... it was a heat-seeking missile, so it would suddenly say, yes, I can see the target. You then literally bunted down, because you couldn't see this airplane, it was blacked out. You were doing it on a radar return. Bunted down until you got the in-range signal and then fired the missile. And because we had an error on the altimeter of about 300 feet, so if the target was at, say, 100 feet, we actually were at minus 200 feet when we were firing off. I mean, it was bloody dangerous, frankly. But we got quite good at it.
And the altimeter difference is caused by the barometric pressure differences.
Yes, exactly right.
The airfield. Exactly.
Well, by the barometric pressure that existed, and when you're doing 400 or 500 knots or 600 knots, as you were to catch a Buccaneer, there's a pressure around the airplane which distorts the actual barometric pressure, and that's called pressure error. And it worked in a way that said, you know, when you to be at 100 feet, you actually had to be at minus 200 feet, and you had no way of telling until they introduced a radar altimeter where you were. You did it all on barometric pressure.
And did people fly into the sea?
Not in my time. We didn't lose any airplanes. We were very lucky. They did lose the odd one later, and subsequently some did. Mainly, I think, curiously enough, not so much at night, because actually when you're absolutely shit scared, which you usually were doing it, the adrenaline is pumping, you're actually performing quite well. Yes. It was very often flying in conditions of, usually by day, in hazy conditions, and perhaps not concentrating quite as much as you do, and people got disorientated and flew straight into a sea, because when you haven't got good visibility, the sea and the sky look almost the same. Unless you're really concentrating, you know, you're just...
And at those speeds, it just needs 1 second.
That's it.
Mm. Can I bring you back slightly to the Greek-Turkish situation?
Yes.
They're both members of NATO.
Indeed.
We are.
Yes.
And you were, just as a matter of geography, you were flying from what subsequently became the Turkish North or the Greek South?
No, we were flying from the sovereign base areas.
Yes.
And in the south of the island, neither Greek nor Turkish territory. Sovereign base British territory, which there was one in the south, one in the west, one in the east, if you like. But the airfield was a place called Akatiri, which was in the south. Although for 3 or 4 months of my tour there, we were actually deployed up to Nicosia, which was the commercial airfield. But we still had some residual interest in the British military there. In fact, we built it. And we built all sorts of things for the Greek Makarios there. So we operated from there, and the Greeks used to come out at night and sit at the restaurant and watch the lightnings take off, because it was one of the most exciting things that was happening in there at the time.
Now, did you engage in exercises with your NATO allies, and did you have to do it independently because of the difficulties, not only that from time to time your allies might have been engaged in doing something which in fact you would be interested in, but they would not have you interested in, and vice versa. Did you engage in that, and were there any difficulties?
Well, the answer is we didn't directly in Cyprus, and the reason was that Cyprus was not in NATO. The bases were not NATO bases; they were British bases. Now, if there'd been a war, the bombers would have flown. But when I was first there, they were a member of CENTO. There was a central treaty organisation, and to that degree. The Canberras, for example, who were there when I first arrived, were tied into CENTO, and they exercised with the CENTO, that's the Turks, the Iranians, who else it was, but certainly those two, not the Greeks, because I don't think they would know. But you're right, then NATO came along, and CENTO collapsed or whatever, and the Turks joined NATO. But we never exercised directly in Cyprus, and I don't think we would have been allowed to, because the Turkish and Greek Cypriots would not accept that this was a NATO area. So what we did, we would go to other places, and then we would exercise with them. And of course, we got a lot of people coming out from UK to exercise with us as well.
Yes. And given the turmoil in the Middle East, from the Six-Day War right through to 73 and all that happened there, and then Gaddafi and so on, did you engage in, I know you were fighters, but did you engage in intelligence gathering with special operations in which one might have been engaged?
I think what we did, the answer is directly, no, indirectly we did, because we did provide some very useful intelligence. We got quite adept, for example, at ship reconnaissance, fighters doing ship reconnaissance, but actually there was nothing else to do it in the area there. So very often I remember tracking down some Israeli intelligence gatherers, a lot of inter-Russian, Israeli, American, none of whom would advertise their presence. And very often, one thing you could tell from our radar that the ship's about. It was very good at picking up ships, big target, big radar return. And after a time, we were tied in, would you please go and have a look at that? And we'd take pictures of them and bring them back. And so we were making a contribution to intelligence, plus the hundreds of airplanes that were around in that part of the world that we intercepted and photographed as well. But I think that was really the extent of it.
Before we move on from your period as squadron leader stroke flight commander in Cyprus, is there anything that you feel you'd like to add to what you've said of your Cypriot experiences?
Well, two things. Just to finish off on the flying side, we started there introducing a combat regime. Because for years the threat had been believed to be, at least, to be bombers, there wasn't really a need for classic air combat. And I think certainly in UK, this skill had been lost. And then a couple of things happened. There was the Arab-Israeli conflict, which showed that, you know, actually it wasn't lost, it was still needed. And we realized that low-level penetration by bombers was going to by fighter bombers was going to involve it. So we introduced a regime of combat, which was very adventurous in its day. Air combat had always had to take place at above certain heights because airplanes are being flung at strange angles, and you know, if you get into a spin, you've got to recover from it, and so on and so on. And usually that height was 7,000 feet. And we said, well, that's no bloody use. You know, if the chap's coming in at 3'6", you've got to be able to combat at 3'6". So we introduced what we called evasion. And I think it was reasonably realistic. We restricted it to a certain amount of G because if you're carrying bombs, you couldn't pull that amount of G, so 4G and a couple of turns and things like that. But actually, it was a wonderful exercise, and people responded to the trust that we gave them, because I think we were putting our heads on the line by doing this. We didn't have, certainly in UK, they weren't touching this sort of thing. It was considered to be dangerous. Out in that part of the world, we introduced it, and very effectively so. And it became the model later on for all squadrons back in UK. So it was quite pioneering stuff. That was fun. The other thing that particularly sticks in my mind was, I think, my first introduction into a real politique of the Greek and Turkish situation. And an impression, and indeed a belief that's stayed with me today, and strongly so, that what we witnessed at first hand in Cyprus in those years, and I was detached to Cyprus on and off throughout the 60s, finishing up permanently based from 1967 to 69 there, was the ethnic cleansing of the Turkish Cypriot minority. And however much it's wrapped up in spin and all sorts of things and clouded by the 1974 invasion, as it's called by our friends the Greeks, the fact is that they were, through the delicate hands of Grivas in particular, eliminating gradually the Turkish Cypriot minority. And we saw that, a particular incident at Kofinu, where they just wiped out a village. And I found it disgraceful, as did my army friends, because we had a lot of army friends out there at the time. The UN were there big time, so we had a lot of army friends, and, you know, listening to them talking about the incidents and the way that the Greeks manipulated it, was quite formative for my views, and nothing has ever changed them. And until the Greek Cypriots will acknowledge, and the Greeks, the part that they had to play in that whole debacle finishing in 1974 and apologise for it in one way or another, then I think, you know, it's going to be very difficult to find a solution.
And unfortunately, whilst the European Union maintains its position of really being prepared to accept the Greeks after
yes.
its own...
And I think that's disgraceful too. And I think my own nation, I've said this to the Foreign Office on many occasions, our behaviour in the 1974 intervention was disgraceful. Now, it might have been real politik in that what could we do about the... don't forget what actually happened was that there was a coup in Cyprus, and the crook who was most famous for shooting British women in the back was put in.